Coming up next on Louisiana Eats, we're sharing stories from modern-day hunters and gatherers, beginning with Danlyn Brennan, who has spent her life foraging wild edibles.
I do remember getting lost in the woods with my younger sister, her telling me that she was hungry. You know, what are we going to do? We're lost in the woods. I'm like, don't worry, we can eat the dandelions. I remember saying things like that to her.
Then we meet 18-year-old hunter Megan Dragon, whose passion for hunting began at a very early age.
It's really amazing. Like, I'm thinking, oh yeah, everybody's like me, but no, nobody's like me.
We've got wild food and even wilder stories on the next Louisiana Eats. That's coming up next, but first, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lori London. Congressional Republicans have reached an agreement on a sweeping overhaul of the nation's tax code. NPR's Kelsey Snell reports that House and Senate negotiators have been at the White House discussing the deal with President Trump.
Senate Finance Committee Chairman Orrin Hatch says House and Senate Republicans reached an agreement, but he declined to share details until after the meeting with Trump. The deal was reached after days of closed-door meetings between House and Senate Republicans. Republican aides say it could take several days before any final legislation is released, and leaders hope to vote on the tax package early next week. Texas Senator John Cornyn, the number two Republican in the Senate, says he believes the agreement will pass, meaning Congress is on track to meet Trump's goal of signing a tax bill before Christmas. Democrats are calling on GOP leaders to slow down the tax bill, which has been speeding towards approval in recent weeks. Kelsey Snell, NPR News, The Capitol.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, who has historically been a champion for U.S.-led peace efforts, says he'll no longer accept the United States as a neutral mediator. This follows President Trump's declaration that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Jerusalem.
Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas told Muslim leaders in Istanbul that Trump promised the deal of the era, but delivered the slap of the era. He said Trump sided with Israel on the sensitive issue of Jerusalem, and so the Palestinians would not accept any role for the U.S. in the peace process. But a new Palestinian poll suggests most Palestinians believe Abbas will cooperate with U.S. peace efforts. Today, Palestinians clashed with Israeli troops in the occupied West Bank, with some protesters reportedly wounded. The Israeli army said Israeli settlers threw rocks at Palestinians. There was rocket fire from Gaza and Israeli airstrikes in response. And Israel says it caught Hamas militants plotting to kidnap an Israeli in the West Bank. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Jerusalem.
The Supreme Court of Greece has ruled that a Russian cybercrime suspect can be extradited to the United States to face money laundering charges related to the digital currency Bitcoin. Joanna Kikissis has more from Athens.
The U.S. Justice Department says Alexander Vinnick, a 38-year-old Bitcoin trader, laundered more than $4 billion worth of the digital currency to fund computer hacking and drug trafficking. He denies the charges. Russia also wants him on fraud charges. The Greek justice minister must now decide whether to send him to the U.S. or Russia to face trial.
That's Joanna Kikissis reporting. As expected, the Federal Reserve is nudging short-term interest rates up another quarter point. Over the past 2 years, the nation's central bank has gradually been hiking its Fed rates from near zero. This is NPR News. As unpredictable Santa Ana winds whip up again, one of the biggest wildfires in California history is still threatening several communities, despite earlier word of containment, and evacuations continue for several seaside enclaves. The Thomas Fire has burned more than 900 structures in Santa Barbara and Ventura counties. Singer and guitarist Pat Denizio of the band The Smithereens has died. He was 62 years old. And as NPR's Rose Friedman reports, the band was heavily influenced by British invasion pop, but stayed close to its New Jersey roots.
For a rock star, Pat Denizio got a late start. He told WHYY's Fresh Air in 2007 that in his teens, he worked for his father's garbage company.
I'd get up at 4 by 4:30. I'd be starting up the garbage trucks and By 5, I'd be walking with my 60-gallon plastic barrel behind people's houses picking up their garbage.
But those years paid off. Denizio and his band, The Smithereens, had a string of hits, including A Girl Like You, Behind the Wall of Sleep, and Blood and Roses. Denizio told WHYY he completed that song on the back of a garbage truck. Rose Friedman, NPR News.
House Speaker Paul Ryan says Congress will stop using taxpayer money for sexual harassment settlement claims lodged against lawmakers. In an interview with Wisconsin Radio WISN, he said it's one of the reform packages lawmakers are working on. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Pajamagram Company, offering 29 matching holiday pajama styles for the whole family, including cats and dogs, and with Charlie Brown and holiday themes, and knits, fleece, and flannel. More at pajamagram.com. And the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana has long been known as sportsman's paradise. That fact is so well known, we even proclaim it on our license plates. On this week's Louisiana Eats, we explore the hunting tradition with a father-daughter team for whom hunting is a way of life. And hunting has always been a way of life for Danlin Brennan, too. The Portland, Oregon native claims she's eaten off the forest floor since childhood. We'll learn about the life of a wild forager and then take a trip to Hawaii to meet another father-daughter team who hunt the Pacific Ocean just the way their ancestors did. We're all about the edible flora and fauna on this week's Louisiana Eats. Sometimes, the more you love something, the more you risk destroying it. That's certainly true when hunting for sport, but what about our connection to flora rather than fauna? For a forager in Portland, Oregon, the consequences of gathering can sometimes be hard to measure.
My name is Danlin Brennan, and I am a forager and been eating off the forest floor since I was a child. When I go out to wildcraft, right, or to harvest, I go alone. I'm pretty much camouflaged. I hide, basically, in the woods, and I sneak around. So I go early in the morning, which is so peaceful. I love it. And it's really personal to me, actually. It's an experience that means a lot to me. So, yeah, I have a lot of people ask to come along, and it's not that I don't want to enjoy my time with them, but it's kind of my own thing to sneak around in the woods.
Foraging is a lifelong calling for Danlin. Her passion is clear, but there's also a tension that runs through her voice, a desire to keep her methods and harvest locations hidden. That's because the more people who know about her world of wildcraft, the smaller it becomes.
It is challenging finding a place where I can forage, and that's usually why I stay so secretive about it. Because, yes, there's public property that I can find, but there's also a lot of private property. And I have in the past asked owners of a property if I could harvest from there. A lot of times they look at me funny or tell me no. I've even had a lady tell me that she was going to sick her dogs on me if I keep collecting those violets. So, I'm cautious, especially when it comes to bringing groups of people to a location. So I lead by example. I don't just go and start ripping things out of the ground. That's not my way.
Used to be foragers were people who went out into the wild and found food. Now
high-end fine restaurants hire people whose job title is forager. So tell us what it means to you to be a forager.
I always thought it was so normal. You know, growing up, I would have to give the credit to Polly Ivins, was a woman who introduced me to eating from nature. So I was introduced to a lot of different edible plants as a child. So I thought it was normal that everybody would just eat from the forest.
Danlin's connection to foraging traces back to early childhood. I asked her to take us back to her earliest memories on the forest floor.
Around 5, 6, 7 years old, grade school. I do remember getting lost in the woods with my younger sister and her telling me that she was hungry. You know, what are we going to do? We're lost in the woods. I was like, don't worry, we can eat the dandelions. I remember saying things like that to her.
Though dandelions can sometimes save an afternoon in the woods, being a small child in the wilderness comes with its share of scraped knees and sometimes worse.
I'm surprised I'm alive, actually. I've had a lot of close calls.
It is wildcraft, after all. For Danlin, foraging is a practice with deep roots. She considers her work to be part of a greater lineage.
And it's our ancestors, of course, because that's what we did. And I know, like in modern times, we can go to the store and get whatever we want. You know, we forget about these things. But I think it moves people so much because there's this deep memory that resurfaces. And whether it reminds them of a specific person or not, I think that memory is in everybody. It's in our DNA, you know, that we have this deep relationship with plants. Recently, I was on an herb walk introducing people to plants in the Pacific Northwest. And afterwards, I had a young gentleman come up to me, and he was so beautiful, kind of like expressing his gratitude for doing this. And he didn't say anything specific about, you know, it was a person that this reminded him of, but it moved him a lot. And he didn't really know why. And he was just so thankful that you just walked with me through the woods, so okay. But yeah, it means a lot to people, and that's what I think is really rewarding.
While Danlin does occasionally lead a flock of fledgling foragers on expeditions, for her, the smaller the group, the better.
I would love to take a group of one person with me. That would be ideal, where I can really have an intimate time with them and explain to them kind of my process, which is intimate and might be funny, but it's almost conversational with the plants. When I go out and I'm looking for a specific, I almost want to call it like a person. It's an individual, this plant that I'm looking for or that I'm going to, you know, take for myself or for other people to make into medicine or for food. So it's kind of a big deal. So I like being with maybe one person, two people, to kind of show them how intimate the process actually is.
I imagine that you must also have a sort of pull and take on this, because if you teach too many people about these things, it could wipe out everything that's growing naturally that you're depending on. Do you feel that tension, and how do you handle that?
Absolutely. You got it. Yeah, I do feel that tension. I understand people are excited. I don't think that people have ill intentions and people are excited, they want to go harvest, but I think education helps a lot, and especially educating people when they're young, educating groups of people who maybe wouldn't naturally be exposed to these things is really important to me too. So I don't want to make it into a trendy thing. I want to reach people who need it. And how else to say that? And so I do work with the Oregon Food Bank, where I volunteer as an instructor gardening for low-income communities. So I like introducing people to the plants when they have a lot of respect for it. It's a give and take. It's not just take, take, take. And us humans, we love to take. And
It's funny, I've had dreams where I'm the one that's taking, and I'm the one that is gathering all these things, and somebody comes out in my dream and is like, hey, you know, don't do that. You realize that you're being very selfish. And so it's definitely in my mind that I'm afraid of doing that, and I'm afraid of exposing things and making it something that someone could abuse. So if I am going to introduce people to this, I really stress the responsibility that you have to take on when going into these wild areas and taking from the earth that way.
Want to get in touch with Danlin to learn how to wildcraft yourself? That's not so easy. With so much of her time spent under a canopy of trees, you probably won't be surprised to learn that she's routinely off the grid.
I'm not that easy to find.
If you're hiding in the forest, I guess not.
I guess not, but it looks like I'm going to have to expose myself at some point. You can find me online. My name I go by, a lot of people know me online, is Dirtfish, which is funny because I do think of myself as kind of swimming through the dirt, right? I'm swimming through life, like in the dirt. I find the dirt to be beautiful. That's where everything comes from. So, you know, I know a lot of people know me by the name Dirt. That's actually a nickname of mine.
Oh, you don't look like your nickname is Dirt.
And it's so funny because people do. They think it's a bad name. And I'm like, no, but everything beautiful comes from the dirt. What are you talking about?
It's really funny. Really good dirt has a really wonderful scent.
Yes, it does. Exactly. And good dirt gives us really healthy plants and vegetables, and then those healthy vegetables and plants then give us healthy animals and humans and everything. So there's this connection again, like I'm saying, that for some reason now people don't, it doesn't come naturally to honor the dirt, right? But I do all the time. So people find me to be a bit funny. That's probably why I try to stay out of the spotlight, because I always have to explain myself.
Portland-based forager Danlin Brennan, also known as Dirtfish. Susan Schott is a publisher and author of several cookbooks that celebrate Southern culture through a blend of photography, stories, and recipes. In her acclaimed book, Wild Abundance, Susan celebrates the spirit and tradition of some of the South's finest hunting clubs. When we sat down with Susan, I asked her about the tradition of duck hunting and to share some of her favorite experiences while exploring the Southern hunting tradition.
The traditions are varied and pure. For instance, we went to Bayou Club, and that was at the invitation of Paul McElhaney. Paul gave the instructions for the day. The next morning, we're going to get up at 4:30. We would be awoken by the guides at 4:30. They would come to our room, knock on the door, give us the temperature for the day so we'd know exactly what to wear, and we get up, and the first thing we do is go into the big, great hall there and have Pappy Van Winkle concoction called an orange sandwich. And that is a wedge of orange and a shot of 23-year-old Pappy Van Winkle. And we chug that down, and afterwards there's a rousing God Bless America by everyone in the room. It's so special. You get chills when you think about it. And so that's a tradition that I thought was really, really special. And then we all headed out to the boats to the hunt.
Out of all the lodges and clubs that you visited, what was the most rustic and what was the most opulent?
The clubs that we visited at Wild Abundance, mainly those were pretty much rustic clubs. There are some that are renowned because of the proliferation of the ducks, one in Stuttgart, Arkansas, called the Circle T. And rather than the focus on the lodge, is the focus on the flight of the ducks. Stuttgart is the duck hunting capital of the world. And that place we went is owned by a gentleman named Chuck Smith. It is a lodge. It was so strange. It had an indoor pool. And then the lodging, the sleeping quarters, were upstairs, and it was really just a dormitory-type sleeping quarters with bunks all along the wall, which is curtains that you put across the bunks. So that was one. And then the Fighting Bayou, which is in Booger Den in Mississippi, they had built a club, and all of the members there realized that they liked to hunt a lot and that their wives were being left at home a lot. They quickly figured out in this day and time the way they could hunt and keep everybody happy was to build a lodge with separate quarters for couples to come and stay, and it got to be a family tradition. There are grandchildren, there are children, there are cousins and nephews, wives that hunt deer. The men go out and hunt ducks. There are a lot of Ole Miss and Mississippi State alums there, and Eli Manning was there that trip. It's a really special place.
I know that most people would look at hunting as a very male-dominated game, but you even hunted down the swamp witches to be in the book.
Well, the swamp witches, who are based in Jackson, Mississippi, that is a rustic hunting camp. But it's wonderful. It's something out of Central Casting. They rough it. And the decor from everything is just over the top pure. So it's one small room and a tiny kitchen, and I think maybe two bedrooms. But it's got this beautiful setting out over Ward Lake. You know, they grew up in families where the men hunted and their husbands hunted, and I think many of them are equestrians, and so they just decided they'd start their own hunting club. And I think they got the swamp witches because there was another word that rhymes with witches that they might have been called before. So they wanted to make sure they were the swamp witches. And so that's what they're doing, and it's still active today. The interesting thing about duck hunting in the night before, sometimes there's duck and sometimes there's comfort food and sometimes there's both. So I know we had a salad and we had a stew and some dessert, but the focus for them was not on the duck. Their focus is on shooting the ducks so that they can take them home and have them throughout the winter and give them to their friends.
Susan, were you a hunter before you started working on this project?
No, I was not a hunter, but I was an outdoors person. And I love it out there. It's beautiful. There's nothing like it to go out before the sun rises and get posted under a tree or in a blind and watch the activity of the morning start. And then the hunters work the ducks. They call that when they're calling the ducks in. They're starting to cup into a flooded timber or come over open marsh. And then to see the skill and the attention and the focus that these hunters have, it's something that resonates with me. I know I would like it, but I say to people, I can't do the book and hunt at the same time because I'm usually watching the photographer and making sure we're getting everything we need to get. I'm trying to pay attention because I don't interview people when we're out. It's just too disruptive. You can't do that.
But you have to be quiet anyway.
You have to be quiet, yes. And you have to be really, really focused. The one thing that Lisa, my photographer, and I are so proud of in all the books we've done, we haven't what we call gotten wet, which means falling because it's treacherous. When you're walking through flooded timber, there are logs down everywhere, and you have to kind of feel with your feet. And Lisa has to keep her equipment dry. Sometimes I have to hold an umbrella for her. And it's very, very focused. So not only have we not gotten wet, we've not seen anybody get wet. So that's a really good thing.
Are you a hunter now?
No. Right now, I'm trying to be a publisher.
Well, you did a very good job of being a publisher.
Well, thank you.
I am so thrilled to have had this hunting conversation with Susan Schott of Wild Abundance. Thank you.
Thank you, Poppy, for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Susan Schott, author of Wild Abundance. When we come back from a short break, we journey to Hawaii's Garden Isle to meet a fisherman whose family's casting traditions go back countless generations. Stay tuned.
Dirty Rice, satisfying your Louisiana music RV since 1991. Join either me, Bill Bolins, or Mr. Lee Klein Peter for the best in Louisiana music. Cajun, Zydeco, blues, swamp pop, you name it, we got a whole lot of rock and roll too. That's Dirty Rice, every Saturday night at 8:30 to 10 p.m. right here on KRBS 88.7 FM and on the internet at krbs.org.
Later today on This American Life, a chicken processing plant in Alabama goes from nearly all white to majority Latino in just a decade. And the workers have a theory about why.
There was a sign put up at the border, work in Iberville, Alabama, poultry.
It's on the border where?
Right as you go into Texas.
So do you think that's true or do you think that's fake?
Yes, it was true.
Are you positive it was true?
Yes.
Later today.
Tonight at 7 on KRVS.
Hi, this is Dan Phillips inviting you to Funkify Your Life Thursday afternoons at 1 and Friday nights at 9 right here on KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and from Ralph Brennan's Redfish Grill. From dock to pot, offering 9 varieties of fresh Gulf fish daily. Lunch, dinner, and private events at 115 Bourbon Street in the French Quarter. For as long as hunters and gatherers have sourced food from the land, they've also harvested from the sea. Next, we have a story from one of the most remote places on Earth, Hawaii. Producer Sarah Holtz took a trip to the island of Kauai and met James Sarmi, a fisherman who casts about in the traditional Hawaiian way.
Hello, my name is James Sarmi. I'm from Kauai, Kapa'a, Kauai.
I met James on a typical gorgeous afternoon in Kapa'a, a village on the east shore of Kauai. Though we met on the main street, Kuhio Highway, we were only steps away from the beach. I quickly learned that the ocean is never far from James's mind. He described what it was like to go shore fishing with his family when he was young.
I remember, going with my dad and we're going to the beach, and he's got his net in his car, and he's got his polarized glasses on and looking into the ocean and then looking for the school of fish, And then he goes down and sets his net up, and, you're kind of excited to see the throw, and he throws his net, and he come up with this fish, and, you run there, you help him pick it up in the ocean, and we would come on land and then take it all out of the net and do it again.
Hawaiian fishing methods vary, from bow fishing to diving to casting out with a small net. The Sarmi family's fishing tradition goes back countless generations, and James has good reason to believe it will continue well into the future.
I'm older now. All my kids know how to fish, and I've even taught my 7-year-old daughter. She's diving with me. I took her about 2 months ago, and my older son, who's 26, got a taco, and then he, for kill him, we bite it between the eyes, and she was like, oh, what is he doing? And she was just so amazed, to watch all of this going on, and so it's something we teach in the family.
The tradition holds strong, but James also sees several threats to the practice, from restrictive state laws to overfishing.
It's not as abundant as it was before. It's kind of actually, it's a little sad to see it disappearing, to be honest, it's something I'm teaching, but I can see it's fading away.
When did you first start to notice it was disappearing?
I'm actually from the Big Island, and I went back to the Big Island to a spot that I was raised at, and fish all day, and we caught nothing, you know. And 7 years ago, I was diving there, and, you know, we would catch all this fish, and we was there all day, and we caught nothing, and kind of heartbroken. It's not there anymore, you know. And I didn't get to jump in and dive and look at the coral and the ocean, you know. We was fishing with poles at the time, and but it's not as abundant as it was before.
Do you know of any conservation efforts on the island?
You know, I know there's certain areas where there are conservation efforts, but, you know, I think to be honest, I think with social media, and a lot of people do fishing and diving, and they like to post all these things they catch. Plenty of them release it, but I see on social media where they catch like 20 to 30 parrotfish. You know, it's like you can't eat that much, you know. I know growing up, we would catch what we eat, you know, what we need to eat, and my dad would stop, and, you know. And as an adult, I remember, you know, when I would go dive, I would ask the neighbors what kind of fish they would want to eat. I would go catch fish, give them their share, keep my share, and that's what I'll teach my kids. We get what we need. That's it. But I think nowadays, you look at social media, everybody's posting, everybody wants the bigger fish, everybody wants more and more, and I think, to me, that's my personal opinion, it's kind of disappearing, you know?
Facing this reality is not easy, as James still takes his father's wisdom very much to heart.
Growing up, you respected the ocean. You know, I remember my dad saying, don't turn your back on the ocean. When I was younger and a little bit, we like to say kalohe, little bit troublemaker, you know, where I thought I could do anything. I got dragged in the ocean one time, and I never forget that. And I learned a good lesson that day, you know. I respect the ocean, and I know the power of the ocean.
With its dense rainforests, Kauai is one of the wettest places on Earth. Thus its nickname, the Garden Island.
One thing I like about the islands is how, like, when the sugarcane plant's flower comes out, as locals we know, that's the time to get octopus or taco, and that's a good time to go and look for it. Also, when the guava falls, different kind of fish come out, and there's some of the signs where you can tie the land to the ocean. There's some of the plants that smell like certain fishes out in the ocean, or even some of the leaf of a plant that look exactly like a fish. Native Hawaiians used to tie all the land with the ocean together as one.
While the fishing tradition is becoming endangered, James says his pull to the ocean is as strong as it's ever been.
You know, my daughter, as I said, she's 7, but at 2, I had her going underwater already. We like to say it's in our blood.
James Sarmi, fisherman on the island of Kauai, and our Louisiana Eats producer, Sarah Holtz.
When she's on her best behavior, don't be tempted by her favors. Never turn your back on Mother Earth.
The states of Hawaii and Louisiana have more in common than you'd think. At the age of 2, James Sarmi's daughter began diving with her dad on the hunt for fish. In the southwest corner of our state, another daughter began hunting animals with her dad at a very young age also.
My name's Megan Dragon. I am 18 years old, and me and my dad's been hunting ever since I was a little kid.
We'll get to Megan and her dad in a minute, but first, some background on how we came to meet them. Recently, the Louisiana Eats crew was in Violet, Louisiana, attending a wild boar cook-off event held by a variety of coastal preservation organizations. You see, the wild boars who roam Louisiana threaten the integrity of our levees by rooting them up. There's many a conservationist working to replant vegetation to preserve our eroding coast, who tells stories of returning to the planting site a week later, only to find all the new plants uprooted and gone. The work of those voracious wild hogs. half a dozen amateur cook teams battled it out, each presenting their own take on the invasive wild boar. Because once again, to save our coastline, we've got to eat them to eradicate them.
Who are these four? You guys want to try them?
Our contribution was the smoked boar jambalaya, and we're pretty happy with the results so far. So
it's all marinated in red wine, white wine, thyme, rosemary, any season you could buy boar or steel is put into this pig.
Eat a boar, they don't tear your land up.
Among the teams was the Chalmette Owls, a group of high school students taking part in the ProStart culinary program, led by Elena Hodges.
We're making an Asian taco. We did the we smoked the pork overnight. We did a nice little Asian rub. We topped it with pickled cucumbers and carrots, a little bit of green onion.
Despite being beginners, the Chalmette Owls had a slight advantage over the competition. They already had some experience cooking wild boar, thanks to a hunter within their own ranks, 18-year-old Megan Dragon.
We've been practicing. She brought in 3 wild boar legs. She deboned them. She brought them in. She seasoned them up. I smoked one. We did 2 more in the oven. We braised them. And the kids loved it. They loved it.
Megan spoke with us about her avocation for game hunting, beginning with her involvement in the cook-off.
Let's talk about hunting pigs. That's really wild that you all were going to be in this competition, but because of you, everybody got to practice. Tell me about how that came about.
Oh, when Miss Elaine came up to me and asked me if I wanted to be in the contest, I was like, yeah, I love hunting. I love hogs. I love doing all of that. I love cooking especially. And bringing that, it mind-blown to my teacher. She's like, you really did bring it? I said, yeah, I brought it. It's cold and everything, so you have to like be careful with it and make sure it doesn't spill or anything. But seeing other people's reactions about me bringing that out, doing stuff with it, people just asking me questions, it's really amazing. Like, I'm thinking, oh yeah, everybody's like me, but no, nobody's like me.
No, nobody's much like you. What do you like the most about deer hunting?
I like sitting in the stand, quiet, everything's all, it looks kind of like dead. And then when the sun comes up and the light hits it, everything comes alive and stuff starts moving around. And then you start hearing stuff, like right when you walk into the stand, oh, you get that, it's just a rush feeling. The one time, the first time I shot my deer, it was with my dad and we had like a very old stand. And I remember just right when the sun came out, it was just one little glare of sunlight came out. The deer just popped right up out of there. When you get the scope right on it and you take a big old deep breath in and out, slow deep breaths, and you just fire. And when you see you hit it, it's an amazing feeling. Like you're shaking all over the place. You're saying, oh my God, I just did this. This is exciting. It's my first deer. And come to find out, the deer that I shot, it only had one antler, so I call it my unicorn deer. Oh, I loved it. It was a rush feeling just doing that. It's kind of hard to wake up in the morning, but once you get that first little wake up, I'm like, oh yeah, I'm going out in the woods, I'm going to have fun, and I'm going to be with my dad, pretty much. And that's what I love about going with them, because he's my dad. Like, I'm his little girl. I have an older sister. It's just me and her. And I'm the little baby in the family. So that's what I love about it.
Not far from Megan and her cook team station was her father, Daryl. After Megan introduced us, I asked him for his take on the sport of hunting and his daughter's growing passion for the pursuit.
I'm Daryl Dragon. I'm Megan's father.
Tell me about where you're from and why hunting, fishing, why all of that is important to you and why you're passing it on to your kids.
Well, I'm born and raised in Plaquemine Parish. My wife is from St. Bernard Parish, 12 miles away. We was what you wouldn't call high school sweethearts. All my life, my brothers and myself, we hunt and fish because we were born, raised up on a farm mostly. And when they were coming up, when they were little, they wanted to go. They always wanted to go with me. So, you know, there's some days when it's real cold and that you can't take them. But when they were little, I would take them in the stand and put them in there and they watch. And then as they got older, I want to go. I want to hunt. I want to shoot a deer and different things. So, you know, you teach them the right and wrongs. You don't teach them oh, you just go out here and it's whatever, and you just kill everything that walks. And we don't do that. We only kill 2 deers a year for the house. Everything we kill, we eat. There's nothing that we don't just go out and slaughter stuff. We make sure, you know, we eat it and we process it all ourselves. We debone it, we cook it, we do everything with it. We even fishing, we do the same thing with fishing. His dad, I was born and raised like that. My grandfather was something instilled in us, and whatever we caught or killed, we ate. You know, raising up on a farm, that's the normal thing you do.
I asked Daryl if he could recall the feelings he experienced as he watched his daughter Megan make her first kill. He became silent for a moment, and I spied a tear in the proud father's eye.
Well, it's kind of emotional because they excited and they get nervous. And when they, my both daughters, when they shot, it was like perfect. The deer didn't walk far. It kind of just dropped right there. And I was like, then after the fact, that their nerves set in, they get all excited and they're jumping up and down. Of course, you know, you got to grab the gun. You secure everything first because they're all excited and jumping up and down. It's pretty cool. And then, you teach them, you got to let them calm down. And then you teach safety after that. And then that's the biggest thing I always preach with them, you know, safety, gun safety and everything. So all these people talk about guns and activists and all that. I'm like, look, I was born and raised from a little kid with guns around his house. Only time we used a gun was for hunting. That was it. You never touched it otherwise. And that's the same thing we instill in them. So maybe my grandkids, I'll be able to teach my grandkids to hunt. Who knows?
Megan Dragon, 18-year-old hunter, and her father, Daryl Dragon. What's being done to help reduce the wild boar in a delicious way? Stay tuned, and we'll tell you all about that when we come right back.
This is Bob Gushereau inviting you to tune in to the music of yesteryears every Tuesday night at 7. We'll listen to music from the great composers from the first part of the last century, done by performing artists then and the contemporaries of today, with a variety of music from my library and the library of many of my friends. That's the music of yesteryears, Tuesday nights at 7, right here on KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
This week on American Roots, how music fought the Cold War. The role of jazz, blues, rock, and more in bringing people together across political lines. I'm Nick Spitzer. We're sending it to Russia with love on American Roots from PRX.
Friday afternoon at 1, right after the Blues Box on KRVS.
There's no better place to be in during the holiday season than in the island of Puerto Rico. So I'm taking you with me on a musical journey of the island during this amazing time. All the way through December until Las Octavitas in mid-January. This is La Bellonera, Thursday at 7 p.m. on KRVS, the 88.7 FM.
Asalto!
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from French Market Coffee. French Market Coffee's premium blended beans are locally roasted in small batches, creating a coffee that can only be called New Orleans Bold. This week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. what is being done to help reduce the wild boar population in a delicious way. First of all, back in 2011, Louisiana's Wildlife and Fisheries Department drastically changed the rules for hunting wild boar. You do still need a basic hunting license, and that'll set you back $15. But with that license, you can hunt wild boar year-round with no limits. That's good news for Charlie Munford of Two Run Farms. Charlie buys wild boar from hunters and transforms it into Charlie's Wild Boar Sausage, a healthy, lean sausage that you can find at your local Rouse's and is available now to grocery stores everywhere. You can also order it from Charlie directly at charliesausage.com. I'm Poppy Tooker, and wild boar sausage makes for some good Louisiana eats.
My name is Emily Deegan, and I'm the founder of St. Hugh. We make fashion-forward field apparel exclusively for women, and we're headquartered here in New Orleans.
Growing up in New Orleans, Emily Deegan was always fascinated with her dad's early morning hunting trips, and she longed to tag along on his adventures. With enough persuasion, Mr. Deegan relented, taking both of his daughters along, introducing them to the beauty and bounty of the Louisiana marsh. But Emily was frustrated that there didn't seem to be any hunting apparel specifically designed for women. Emily's company, St. Hugh, named for the patron saint of hunters, has changed all that with her clothing designs made by women for women. And by the way, her original patterns are so beautiful that women are enjoying the clothes in lots of places besides the duck blind. Emily, I am so interested by your company and everything that you do. You have been a hunter all your life.
I have been, yes, ma'am. I grew up duck hunting with my dad in Delacro, Louisiana, and I could never find hunting apparel that fit or felt good, much less looked good. So from a very young age, I'd had this idea to bridge that gap in the market by making more fashion-forward field apparel for women. And I'm really excited to announce that, you know, we celebrated our one-year anniversary just a couple weeks ago, so we launched last year, and our first line was, of course, for female hunters.
Tell me about your earliest memories of duck hunting with your dad.
My sister and I, we had sort of a mysterious image of hunting because we knew that, you know, it was something he did on the weekends, and he would kind of wake up in the middle of the night to sneak out, and then later the next day he would come back, you know, smelling like the marsh. You know, it just seemed very mysterious to us, and so we were just incredibly interested in joining him. And so when we were about 10 years old, you know, after years and years of begging him to take us with him, he finally did. And I'm not going to lie, at first, like, we were really excited because we kind of felt like we were part of an exclusive club because we were always, most of the time, the only kids and always the only girls that went hunting with him and his friends. But it was incredibly early. It was incredibly cold. And like I said, it was very difficult to find the right gear. So it wasn't so much that we loved the act of hunting itself at first, but we loved feeling like we were part of this, you know, like I said, exclusive club.
Yes, and a boys' club, too.
Yes,
what
absolutely.
Did your girlfriends think about what you were doing with your dad on the weekends?
They really didn't ask too many questions. You know, it was kind of just, oh, there's that weird thing that she does. It wasn't something that most of my friends necessarily did with their dads, so they weren't really familiar with it. They really didn't ask a lot of questions.
So when did you start cooking what you were killing?
I started cooking what I was killing relatively early. I've always loved to cook. And at first, I have very vivid memories of chopping up the breast meat to make duck stew. And later, I got a bit more creative. One of my absolute favorites, it's been one of my go-tos for a long time, is a really delicious tea-smoked duck, where you actually mix black tea leaves and brown sugar into the wood chips at the bottom of the smoker. You stuff the cavities with a variety of fresh herbs, and it provides sort of a different flavor that a lot of people who tell me that, you know, they usually don't like the taste of duck meat, they really like that distinct flavor.
Oh, I love the flavor of duck.
I
don't like it when game gets too disguised. Do you remember the first time you shot a duck? I guess that must have been your first kill.
Yeah, I do. It's interesting because until I really had my own shotgun, you know, we were kind of just more along for the ride. But then one Christmas under the Christmas tree was my very own shotgun. And after that point, I felt like I was more accountable and I really, you know, needed to produce results now that I had the right tools.
Did you expect to find shotguns under the Christmas tree?
Well, I can tell you that my sister and I were surprised, but even more surprised was my mom. I don't think that she was necessarily consulted before my dad made that purchase from Santa, and I'll never forget the look on her face that morning. she was perhaps the most shocked.
And so how did you learn to shoot the gun?
My dad would just teach me in the marsh. He, every time we went out, would provide pointers. He would tell us how to stand, how to hold the gun. One thing that sort of made me dislike hunting at first was the kick of the gun. It was intense for a young girl, and just for women in general, because our collarbones protrude more than men's. So that was something that took some getting used to. And in the early days, we just kind of combated that with lots and lots of layers.
Oh, gosh. When you were little, what were you dressing in to go hunting?
We just shopped in the men's and boys section of Cabela's and Bass Pro Shops. And so we'd buy these clothes that were entirely too long in the arms, that had no real product specifications for women and for the types of difficulties that women shooters face. So I had certain things that I knew I definitely wanted to incorporate in a product because I was looking for things that I wasn't finding in the apparel I was wearing. So one of the things I was really excited to do was build directly in a lightweight padding material. It's called spacer fabric that protects the shooter from the blowback of the gun. But in testing it, I found that it also makes carrying more comfortable. So rather than just putting it on one side of the garment, like on the right or left shoulder, we put it on both sides so that for people who, you know, are hiking, carrying backpacks, they still experience that same level of comfort. The other thing was I was always disappointed with the pocket options in a lot of the apparel I was wearing. So I made all of my vests and jackets have really deep pockets, which can fit, you know, over a box of shells. So that was another thing we're excited
great
to do.
Great specifications. Did you learn how to sew, or how did you go about constructing even the samples? Tell me about that process.
I did. So I've also been sewing from a very young age. I remember taking sewing classes at Ursuline Academy in the summer. So that's something that I've dabbled with for a while as well. But I really didn't have a background in technical apparel design or garment construction. So I sort of worked backwards from what I knew I wanted in an end product and worked with a development house that specialized in working with first-time designers. So I had a basic concept of, you know, this is what I want the final vest or jacket to look like. This is the basic style. This is how deep the pockets are going to be. So I provided to them very detailed technical drawings with very technical specifications as to the depth of the pockets and so forth. And they actually took my drawings and made them into workable patterns.
Something that really interested me were the marsh patterns of the fabric that you use to make the clothing. And they're really striking, and they're very beautiful, and I've seen a lot of camouflage, and I had really never thought before how different our marshes look than most of the camouflage gear on the market. Tell me about that process.
Absolutely. So I wanted to make garments that were fashion-forward enough for non-hunters to be interested in, but were also going to be garments that female hunters could wear both in the fields and then casually as streetwear. So in doing so, I really rethought what I wanted in a camouflage. So throughout the course of a hunting season, I took thousands upon thousands of photos of the marsh grass and surrounding terrain, and I time-lapsed those photos so I could see how the colors changed. I then adjusted for, you know, weather and other geographic-related factors to come up with a color palette. And I experimented with a variety of more fashion-forward prints and settled on a herringbone style because I liked the way the sharp angles of that print emulated the blades of grass in the marsh. So we developed our own herringbone-style marsh print. It incorporates a variety of greens and browns. It's something that both hunters and non-hunters have been interested in. About half our customers are actually non-hunters, and that's what we cut all of our jackets and vests in our first line.
Isn't that interesting? Tell me about some of the women who are hunting in your gear. What sort of stories have you heard from the field?
So it kind of depends. So we've sold all across the country. Some women like to take our products upland hunting for quail hunts and pheasant hunts because in hunts like that, you're doing lots and lots of repeated shooting. And so they really valued the spacer protection. When you're marsh hunting, you know, hopefully you're shooting a lot, but you never know how the day is going to go. So they're really using our gear more for the camouflage properties. And then interestingly, there's a huge hunting community in California. We were fortunate enough to visit with some of those customers. I created the pattern with hunting in Louisiana and hunting in the marsh in mind, but, you know, they've reported that it's really successful as camouflage in their part of the world as well.
Well, they have rice fields in California too.
Right.
So I bet you they've got very hungry waterfowl in their rice fields.
Absolutely.
Listeners who want to find your hunting gear, where do they go?
They go to our website, www.sthugh.co. That's .co, not .com. We sell direct to consumer there. We also sell on Amazon. And if they sign up for emails on our website, they'll be notified whenever we do a pop-up near them.
Oh, what great fun. And obviously, since we started out talking about things you like to cook, I imagine that people can go to your website and get some favorite recipes of yours as well.
Absolutely, yeah. So we've got a couple pheasant recipes, some of our favorite venison recipes, and of course, duck recipes.
Well, I can't wait to start cooking, Emily. Thank you so much for coming to talk with us, and congratulations on your really, really interesting, wonderful startup business. I hope everybody takes a look at it. I want to wear some.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Emily Deegan, founder of St. Hugh Hunting Apparel for Women. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Have you missed an episode of Louisiana Eats? Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com, where you can also subscribe to the podcast and take us with you wherever you go. If you love Louisiana Eats, let others know and help like-minded Louisiana food lovers find our show by leaving a review on iTunes. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and from Dickie Brennan Steakhouse, a local New Orleans steakhouse serving prime beef in New Orleans French Quarter. Original theme music by Johnny Sketchin' the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Marvis, and to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Don't forget to find our recipes and see what we're up to at poppytooker.com. You can check us out on Instagram and Facebook, too. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.